Look inside your dictionary and L-O-V you will see. But nothing in the dictionary will tell you what that word can be.
Love
is a four-letter word.
I am here with Jerzy Skolimowski.
Jerzy.
Jerzy, okay. Jerzy, we'll say Jerzy to make things easier, who is the director and co-writer of Four Nights with Anna. Jerzy, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you.
First off, I wanted to actually ask a question that goes back to a 1982 film you made called Moonlighting, involving, of course, a group of Polish workers who were asked to work on a London home. Now, in Four Nights with Anna, the house also figures into the equation. You have Leon's house, which is this kind of ramshackle domicile he assembles with stray bits of lumber and the like. At one point, he applies a chainsaw to put in a window. And I wanted to ask you about starting from the home to get a kind of lay of the land. Is this kind of the Nabokov notion? I mean, he could not write a story without knowing his topography. Is this a similar case with you?
True, yes, yes. I need to know the place exactly how it is, because I am already planning the camera moves, you know. The time when I write the script, I can already see, you know, how I'm going to film it. And therefore the knowledge about the place is that important.
How does location dictate the motivations of the characters in situations like this?
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. You know, sometimes when you find some interesting thing in a neighborhood, you can even, you know, extend your location. I'm always open to accept anything which would be good for the movie, so not that I'm fixed on one place. No, it's if I can find something additional, then I'm always going for it.
I'm wondering if you have essentially a loose foundation with which to work from, and then as you go out and scout locations, this adds essentially to the look that you have, or the topography with which the characters are running through and the like. Or?
Yes, I think that's quite normal, you know. Yeah. Everybody does it, so.
I wanted to also ask you about something that Bruce Hodgson wrote in a Senses of Cinema profile about you, and this is going to be a rather lengthy question, so bear with me, but he wrote, rather than aggressively or apprehensively dissecting space, as is often the case in the era of the Steadicam, Skolimowski scans it fresco-like in lateral tracks consistent with his objective-subjective dialectic. Now, he was referring specifically to your film Walkover, in which he noted that this subjective journey worked in tandem with the camera, this kind of clash between the old and the new world. However, one might likewise see the lateral tracks in this film, Four Nights with Anna, because you do indeed have a clash between the old and the new world in this. Your camera also tracks through houses, through bushes, and I'm wondering if this constant clash between old and new, whether it is the solidarity movement or whether it is essentially a kind of social movement that is not so politicized, whether this is something that really is a great galvanizing force when you whip up your narratives.
Well, you may be surprised, but I'm not thinking about all those things at all.
Okay.
I'm thinking only about making a movie. So whatever comes with it, it's probably either subconscious or is just created by the film critics who can see the things which you know, so... a good reason to put it into nice words, like you quoted just now. But believe me, I don't think about those things.
So it's all intuitive, essentially.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. For me, the most important is the story. You know, I'm telling the story, and I am not speculating on what it means more than it is. You know, it's a story, and of course, one can always find some additional interpretation and some theoretical sights into it.
But I'm wondering if you're perhaps being a little disingenuous here with your answer. After all, there is this chronicle with the ring, which of course made me think logically of the old Jewish tale of putting the ring on the corpse and the like, and here you have it in reverse. And here Leon actually uses this as a kind of code with which to act and use his severance pay on purchasing a new particular ring. And so I'm wondering, when you think about a situation involving a ring, I mean, clearly that is a symbol. So it's not entirely just basic storytelling, I would think.
Well, to me, it is a basic story, and I don't treat it as a symbol at all, because, you know, logically, this ring belongs into the story. Mm-hmm. He buys this ring for specific purpose.
Yes.
He executes that purpose. And again, if does it mean something more, fine, that's the benefit of it.
But this is where audiences come in. You essentially exculpate yourself from responsibility for symbolism and critical analysis of things like this.
I rather do, because, you know, I think you know, the once again, I have to say, the story is the most important. Everything else is just the, you know, how would I describe it? It's
the additional icing on the cake, I suppose.
Exactly. Those are the words.
Okay, fair enough. Well, let's talk actually about Leon's movement. I was really fascinated by it because he constantly circles around people. He's clumsy. He slips in the mud. And again, I was rather taken with a larger allegorical meaning of what this particular movement might mean, because it's definitely misfit-like movement from him. And I'm wondering how this came about and how this emerged.
When I was writing this story, I thought that the character should have a specific complex, you know, that he should be extremely withdrawn and shy. And to manifest it the best way, you know, as you probably noticed, there's a very little dialogue in a movie, so he practically is not saying anything. He's got maybe 3 dozen of words for the whole film. But physically, he has to present that character which I wanted to create. So I thought that his walk should be kind of specific, and therefore when I choose the actor, I put some heavy stuff into his boots, you know. I put some lead, so each of his boots were like 5 kilograms heavy. Therefore, he had to walk like this. That was the natural.
That explains what. Did he slip because of this, or was that planned? I'm sure.
No, the slips were done for purpose, because I need some light moments. You know, it's a very gloomy story, and I didn't want to have the audience, you know, be sad all the time. So I purposely planted those moments when one can laugh or at least smile, you know, and have a little bit relaxation from that tragedy, because this is the tragic story, tragic love, you know.
Well, there's did the ingots in the books perhaps dictate certain improvisational moments, or was this largely planned from the get-go in the script? I mean, did anything come about from some of these developments to make Leon have this walk and the like? Or?
Basically, it was more or less written, but of course, I'm known for being open to any kind of improvisation, so I always incorporate some accidental stuff into my films. And it also happened in this one. So I would say that it's like 80% of it was already in the script, and 20 came along the way when we were shooting it.
Any specific examples of this 20%? Or?
Well, you know, the party, for example, when he visits her after the birthday party, he actually, I planned that he would step silently through the window, but he had a misfortune and he collapsed on the floor, making a huge noise. So therefore, the sleeping woman should react somehow. So I had to improvise immediately her reaction into it. She didn't wake up, but she had to say something, or, you know. So I put, I gave her a new line, and she's saying, "I'm not dancing anymore." you know, with her eyes closed. So that was typical stuff of that 20%, let's call it.
I also wanted to ask you about one of the interesting ethical dilemmas of this film. You're looking at Anna from an objective point of view, Leon's point of view. But we have very little information to go on here, and so it's a really astonishing leap of faith. And plus, the details become, you know, a little bit unsettling because we want to know what Leon's up to and the like. And I wanted to ask you about this relationship between the objectifying this character and presenting a sort of subjective moment. I have another question in relation to Leon, but I wanted to talk about Anna first.
No, the whole character of Anna is seen through Leon's eyes. She never appears when he's not watching her. It's always when he watches her. But fortunately, I found enough different situations for her, so it's not all only when he's there in the room when she's asleep and she's doing all things around her, but also for example there's a car accident and she being her being a nurse, you know, she is the you know the helping the victim of the car accident, but it has to be seen by Leon. So I had to create the scene that he is on the attic of the hospital, doing some cleaning job, and by accident he comes to the window, hears the crash, and then is there at the window when she appears. So always it was calculated that if she has to be seen on the screen, he must be somewhere near and to be able to see her.
There seems to also be an underlying theme that we must look at society, any society, whether it's Poland or here, we must consider all members of society, even those who are screwed up, even those who have a history of being in prison and the like. Leon knocks over the ashtray and is then commanded to pick it up, in which case we then start to sympathize with him, and then we start to kind of come to terms with what this guy is a little bit. That and also, of course, the rape scene in prison. These two moments taken together create a situation in which we're intended to sympathize with Leon. And I'm wondering, though, if we are intended to sympathize with him, does this work against the idea I had presented earlier?
Well, they are both very good scenes, you know. That's
okay.
That's
fair
the
enough
most
answer.
Important reason. And of course I wanted to play with the audience. I purposely put the scenes in the beginning when the audience can almost accuse him of being really bad guy or a murderer, perhaps. You know, he's buying the axe, you know.
Yeah. And the first image we see has a hand coming out of the bag.
Exactly, yeah. You know, so by building that, then I try to clean his image little by little, you know, so the audience may feel, well, maybe he's not such a bad guy. And then later on, maybe he's quite likable.
Yeah.
And therefore, what I wanted to achieve is that the audience would be a little bit ashamed of themselves, that they accuse him so eagerly in the beginning, that they sort of fix him. All right, this is the guy. And no, he's just the opposite. And that's what I show consequently, you know, throughout the film.
So if there is any theoretical agenda that you bring to the table, it's messing with the audience's interpretations. Like, for example, the flashbacks. Are these flash forwards? Are these flashbacks? It falls into this general cyclical theme throughout the particular movie. And likewise, for example, the dead cow floating along the river, which is the most surreal image, perhaps, in this entire film. So really, it seems to me that you're saying that your motivation is to constantly unsettle the audience in some sense so that they're constantly rethinking their initial judgments based off of everything they've seen before.
It is exactly what I wanted. And talking about dead cow, you may be surprised again, but that was the very first image I ever had thinking about how to tell this story. I thought, well, okay, he should be seen when he's fishing. But, you know, fishing is a dull scene. You know, how many times you can see the guy standing with that stick, you know.
Yeah.
It's terribly dull. So what can happen? All right, a dead cow floating on the river. And that was it.
And it's certainly something that isn't seen too often in cinema,
I think. I don't think I've ever seen a dead cow floating in a river.
I wanted to also ask you about the waterfall that hangs in Anna's house. There's also an old clock that hangs in Anna's house. So again, one is tempted to read this as a dichotomy. I'll avoid a theoretical interpretation of this and just simply ask you how the decor was settled upon in Anna's abode.
That was the idea, how to decorate her room. You know, she's not an elegant person. She's not high class. You know, she's rather simple. Women of age of 30-something doing a quite simple job, you know, and therefore, and also living, remember that this place, it's not like her private place, it's the, how you call it, is the workers' barrack, the hostel.
Yes.
It's a hostel, yeah. You know. So what would she bring of private stuff into the hostel? The bed was owned by the hostel. The table, most likely, too. You know, the chairs as well. But what she would bring? And I thought, well, maybe she got the cuckoo clock from her grandmother. So, okay, let's put that. And what about something which would give us a little bit of light? Because we mostly see them in the night. What can bring us a little bit of light? And there was the idea, okay, let's buy this terrible thing, which, you know,
which I've seen in almost every catalog, you know.
Well, and that was mostly for the light, but mm-hmm. It also brings again the very
sound.
Good sound, yeah. Very good sound, and you would probably say that it means a lot.
It does mean a lot. I mean, I interpreted this as the most artificial item you could possibly place in this home, in this barracks. It's almost occluding the sounds that we are supposed to hear of the natural world or the real world or where people like Leon inhabit. So I wanted to ask, and it's an obvious question, why there was a 17-year gap between this film and your last one. Was this a case where you actually were writing scripts? I know you appeared in many films such as Mars Attacks and Eastern Promises, in which you almost stole almost every scene. But I am curious as to why you took such a long break. Is this a situation where you could not get scripts initiated because of financing situation? Or what happened?
No. It's much simpler than that. Mm-hmm. You see, my last film, which I made 17 years ago, it was very mediocre. Mm. Picture, and I was upset with myself. I thought, well, I think I'm on the wrong path. You know, those are not the films I really want to make. I'm just executing the job. You know, I'm well paid, but I don't have any artistic satisfaction out of my creation. And it's not a creation with capital C. It's rather, you know, small C, small creation.
Yeah.
And therefore, I thought, okay, I take some time off making the films, and I can devote myself to painting, which is my real passion of my life. Mm-hmm. Before I become filmmaker, I was already a painter. And when I was making all those films, I didn't have time to paint. You know,
yeah.
Occasionally I paint something, but I couldn't have a professional exhibitions,
yeah.
Not at all, because you don't have enough paintings to show. So I thought, okay, I will paint maybe for a couple of years. I didn't plan the 17-year-old break, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But year comes after year, and I was quite successful as a painter. Those exhibitions were here and there on the both sides of the big water, you know, and in Europe, especially, there were quite well received. But also here, you know, I had a couple of exhibitions in Santa Monica, where I live, and some of my paintings were bought by some prominent people. Therefore, you know, I quite enjoy myself, become a young artist. You know, in the age of 55, I started to be a young artist. Finally, I had enough time to paint.
You're in good company, because I know Ralph Bakshi, he quit filmmaking to become a painter as well. But still, you were acting here, and you were...
Yes, well, you know, you can hardly make a living out of selling the painting, especially yeah. that I didn't want to sell cheaply. Mm-hmm. So I sold only... within those 17 years, I maybe sold 20 paintings, you know. And, you know, the biggest price I got for the painting was about something like $25,000, which is not a lot of money if I should live out of it for half a year, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
So I had to act mostly to make living. Mm-hmm. And since I treat the acting as the easiest money one can get, you know, because acting doesn't cost me any effort.
Yeah.
It comes natural. If the part is suitable for me, then I'm not working. I'm just enjoying myself and being very well paid for.
I'm wondering, though, if Cronenberg took you aside and say, hey, Jerzy, when are you going to make another movie? I'm sure he must have done that at some point.
Everybody was asking that yeah. question, you know. I realized that I have a kind of special position. Whomever I work with, you know, like it was Taylor Hackford when he cast me in White Nights, it was probably my largest part, you know. I had a third name on the credits just after Gregory Hines
and Baryshnikov. Yeah.
And Baryshnikov. So I was there on the screen.
I could assure you, you out acted Baryshnikov.
well, that's another thing. But I had this character within myself because I observed the KGB guys working all around us in Poland. So I know how they behave, how charming they can be. So I put some charm into that character, which Taylor particularly liked, you know. He said, oh, that's great, because this guy is not, he's very bad guy, but also he's got some charm. And that's it, you know. Yeah. No effort.
So, really, it was just easy money, then?
Easy money, exactly. And all those parts are coming by accident. I'm not hunting them. I'm not going for any casting sessions, you know. If people who know me then approach me and they say, listen, there is such a part, then yes, I go for it, but I am not a kind of professional actor who is going, you know, every day for the casting session and tries to do that character or the other character. My emploi is rather limited, especially that, as you can hear, my English is also.
Oh, I think you're doing all right.
Limited, and therefore I can only play foreigners in American films, and that's what I did. You know, altogether within that period of 17 years, how many parts did I play? Maybe 8, maybe 10. Not too many, no.
I have to ask you about collaborating with Polanski on the script for Knife in the Water. Probably I just have a general, how did this come about? I mean, this to me is, I think, one of the great films, I would argue, of the last 50, 60 years. And I think a lot of that is also contingent upon your contributions as a screenwriter.
Well, we know each other with Roman long time, because we are like a groupies of the jazz men, you know, where the jazz was played in under communist regime was almost like a partisan action, or almost like a bit of resistance. The jazz was not allowed to be played or even to listen to, because it was an American movie, an American style of life, you know. That's what was wrong with it. But we liked jazz, and we were secretly, you know, going from location to location where jazz was played. And we were like a circle of, I don't know, a few hundred people doing this, and Roman was among them. Then he went to study in the film school. I started to write a poetry, and then I decided to go to the film school. Roman just finished, but we met during my exams. Roman was an assistant to one of the professors, and because I already had written one script before that, so he knew that I can write, and he said, "Why don't you collaborate with me? I have a story which goes on in the summer, and it involves three people, and so on and so on." I said, "Fine, but you know, why do you need the whole summer for this? You practically can squeeze it into one day." And yeah. Said, "Oh, really? Oh, okay, yeah, let's do it then." He's got the story, but I got the formula how to.
You can find things for him. Yeah. Was it your idea to set it on the boat like that?
Or? No. He's got everything. He's got the boat. He's got who are those three people, you know, and basically most of the events. But he didn't have the structure.
Yeah.
You know, and I was my knowledge about script writing was at that time greater than his, so I was the one who was saying, no, you have to do it this way, and we collaborated very nicely. Between us two, we were playing the three parts, you know, once I was a boy and he was a girl, then he was a man and I was a boy, you know, and we were saying again and again the same dialogue, and I had an obsession to make it as short as possible, as few words as possible. So all the time when we were acting those parts, when one by mistake said didn't use the word, so I was immediately losing that word from the script, you know, only necessary words were written.
Something that, of course, carries on with Four Nights with Anna, as we've just established. Do you think that dialogue, too much dialogue, really gets in the way of the visual element?
Definitely. I don't like those talking heads, you know, and particularly when you have the dialogue between two people, you have to cut. You have to cut the picture. You have to show, this face and then that face, you know, and it becomes almost like a television. And I like those long shots, you know, uninterrupted, and you can see what really is happening with those people. So as little dialogue as possible.
I'm also curious, one last question, whether political tension, of which you have managed to get into trouble with some of your films over the years, is something that accelerates the creative process for you. It seems that restricting dialogue is one thing, at least just from a formalistic standpoint, but I'm curious if a political atmosphere is that is particularly limited or that is castigating other filmmakers or castigating you is something that that encourages your creative process in some sense.
Does, you know, my films which I made in Poland still under communist regime was, there were always a kind of protests against what was going on, not the obvious protest, because then it would be subject to the censorship. Actually, yes. Once I overdone it, I did a really anti-Stalinist film, which was banned for so many years. But in my early films, my first three films, there are some, you know, bits and pieces which, you know, the censor kept his eyes closed and said, all right, that could go. But people, the audience, were getting the messages. That, you know, that would make those films popular. That the fact that one dares to say, oh, we are not in such a happy society, not at all.
I mean, I bring this up in light of your very critical answer to your last film before this one, and in which you've said that it was mediocre. I'm wondering if political tension has in some sense contributed to the zest of your own films in your view, or why do you think that there was a sort of slip in quality? Do you attribute any personal scenarios or just creative problems in general, or what happened?
I probably thought too much about money and too little about art, you know, that was the case. With that particular film 17 years ago, and I don't think it's healthy, you know. I am a real artist, and when I betrayed this, it doesn't work. And this is why I had to take such a long break to renovate myself as an artist.
How important is the audience, though?
The audience is important, obviously, but fortunately there is an audience for the art as well, not only for the films with the car chases and lots of special effects. There are people who want to really see the this is practically a love story.
Yeah.
Remember, this is very, very strange, but it's a love story. So everybody can identify, you know, with those feelings, how far you can go with the being pushed by love, you know, how big risk one can take, you know. And I think for that, I can find the audience.
Well, Jerzy, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you for taking the time out. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.